Legendary jazz pianist and composer Dave Brubeck tells the story about creating this tune. I'm singing this melody that became Unsquare Dance in my mind all the way driving into New York. We never wrote it down. We had to take two takes on it because we didn't have an ending. And on the record, you can hear Joe Morello laugh at the end. And I said, leave that on the record. And it's still on the record. But this became a hit. And it was never written down. We never rehearsed. It was all just thought of at the moment. Then this stupid thing becomes a hit, and I could work on something for 5 years and not get a hit. And that happens all the time. Brubeck continues, there's lots of ways of playing. There's a way of playing safe. There's a way of using tricks. And there's the way I like to play, which is dangerously, where you're going to take a chance on making mistakes in order to create something you haven't created before. But if you're playing in the second category, where you're using things you've used before, that's good, but it's not the creativity I'm looking for. And there is a time when you can be beyond yourself. You can be better than your technique. You can be better than most of your usual ideas. And this is the whole other category that you can get into. I'm always hoping for the nights that are inspired, where you almost have an out-of-body experience. It's like an athlete. I played a lot of sports, and it's the plays in basketball that weren't worked out that are the ones that are just fantastic that you remember. We don't know the power that's within our own bodies, and there are times when you can reach that. That's what you're constantly looking for, is to get beyond your usual capabilities. And you know that that's possible. You can't say what causes you to be inspired. Like Einstein will say, there's always the unknown. In anything that he thinks about, there's something beyond him and beyond man. And this is the area you want to get into, whether a guy is jumping off a ski lift, all of a sudden he's going to fly further than he ever has in his life. And he couldn't practice to do exactly that. He practiced other techniques, but one day, all the technique is behind him, and there's this other inspiration. You can call it God or faith or almost anything, but it's beyond yourself. Words of Dave Brubeck in a conversation with Hedrick Smith for the PBS documentary Rediscovering Dave Brubeck. And we should remember what Brubeck tells us there about Joe Morello and his laugh at the end of Unsquare Dance. It's certainly a sign of surprise and delight in the turn the tune has taken and the way they did end it. For Dave Brubeck, though, it seems like an exclamation point, a laugh acknowledging the infusion of what some would call grace, because these players trusted each other and trusted the process. They took the risks and wound up with something new, something they couldn't have designed if they set their minds to it. They broke through even their own expectations, taking themselves and us as listeners into a new space, a new place, a fun place. And for Brubeck, there's a life lesson there. There is joy. And even as a young player, Bill Carter picked up on that. He could feel the delight these musicians were taking in making something larger than the sum of the parts. And not only was Bill Carter inspired in his own performing as a jazz pianist and band leader from afar, he was given the enormous gift of developing a long-standing friendship with Dave Brubeck, which bears fruit for all of us in concerts like the one this Sunday in Clark Summit, as the Reverend Bill Carter and the Presby Bop Quartet present a program titled The Unheard Brubeck, this Sunday afternoon, April 23rd at 4 at the First Presbyterian Church in Clark Summit, where the Reverend Bill Carter is pastor. The concert is free and open to the public. Bill Carter paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about Dave Brubeck and his music in anticipation of Sunday's concert. And we began with a very important person in Carter's life, In her wisdom, she sensed something that Dave Brubeck might have to offer her young grandson, Bill.
When I was fumbling around as a pianist, and musical critics will think that has never ended, that zone of my life, 12, 13 years old or so, my grandmother gave me a paper grocery bag and said, take this home and listen to it. Well, I took it turned out to be them, two LPs, Dave Brubeck Quartet live at the Newport Jazz Festival, and another one with Mickey and Pluto on the cover. It was Dave Diggs Disney. And it was pretty cool because I put it on and give a little whistle and hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go, and Alice in Wonderland, which would later be covered by Bill Evans. But the one that really stunned me was Someday My Prince Will Come. I never particularly liked that song in Snow White. I thought it was sappy. I thought it was it was as washed up as those stairs that she was lathering down before Prince Charming woke up and showed up. But what Brubeck did with that knocked me on my tail. They began, he played at Rubato out front, and then all of a sudden they went into time and Paul Desmond played a stunning, beautiful solo on it. And then the rhythm changed, and Brubeck started his solo, but he couldn't decide if he was going to stay in 3-4, 2-4, 4-4, or something else. And I laughed out loud. It was like, even though I was a hack musician, I was astonished that these guys were making something in the middle of it. And I never, at that point in my musical life, had gotten to the point where I had been around people who enjoyed making music, much less practicing it, which was my frame of reference. And you could hear the delight in how they went back and forth, how they communicated through rhythms and chords and melodic fragments. And I thought, I want that. I don't know what it is, but I want that. So in time, I thought that as I developed some skills as a jazz musician, I thought, you know, we can begin to kind of touch this. There are some tricks he does with the rhythm and such, the harmony. But then I had the occasion to meet Dave. I had him sign that record at some point in our friendship. I gave it back to my grandmother, and I said, this is for you. And she said, oh, I don't know. I gave it to you. But she was, like, thrilled I had met the guy and that it had come full circle. When she passed a year ago at 102, she bequeathed the album back to me. So that's the quick version of the story of Someday My Prince Will Come and my introduction to the music of the Dave Brubeck Quartet.
She's an extraordinary woman because she could see something in you that she knew would respond some way.
I think so. Remarkable lady. Graduated at 15 from high school at a small rural high school in western Pennsylvania. Smart enough probably to have gone to Smith or to Vassar, but the funds weren't there and the dream wasn't possible. I want to know how she had these records. And I also wanted to know how she had old 45s and 78s of Fats Waller, the original Benny Goodman quartet, a little bit of Harry James. She, apparently, she lived in Oil City, Pennsylvania in Venango County. Her husband, Grandpa, was a traveling salesman. Had three daughters. My mother was the oldest. And from what I can tell, music regularly itinerated through that part of Pennsylvania. I mean, go figure. But she had stories of Louis Armstrong standing next to an upright piano, and as he would play, he would begin to perspire. And there were a stack of handkerchiefs on top of the piano, and he would take one up and wipe his brow and then drop it on the ground and keep going and pick another one up, wipe it off. And I would love to have the DNA from one of those handkerchiefs. Pops was a remarkable musician. I was listening the other day to a recording he did with Brubeck. Brubeck, with his wife, wrote this piece called The Real Ambassadors, and it was, I believe, 1961. It would still have a lot of political capital these days. They were taking racism on. There is a piece where Dave wrote and his wife wrote the lyrics for called They Say That I Look Like God. And Louis Armstrong sings this, could God be black? And behind him, there is this Gregorian chant, like background with a choir. And then speaking about how creativity in the arts really could be our gift to one another globally. Dave and Iola saw this through the work that they did, the travels that they made, and the stories that they reported.
You have a long history with Dave Brubeck, as you hinted.
I love the sound of the classic quartet that lodged in my memory and my heart very early. When I heard Brubeck's band for the first time in 1980, it was harsher, it was fiercer, and it was at what they called the Fryhofer's Jazz Festival at Saratoga Springs. Went with a couple of friends from high school. We were all in college at the time. Brubeck came on, and he was playing with a clarinetist who was nothing like Paul Desmond. And his son was playing electric bass, so it wasn't the classic Eugene Wright sound. And they played, like I said, very fiercely. So I just kind of dismissed it, to the point that when I was in graduate school in Princeton, I saw a poster one time that Brubeck was coming to do his Christmas cantata, and I thought, I don't know. And didn't bother to go to this free performance of La Posada, which is a tremendous piece. So it really, it kind of all went underground until 98, when I had a series of invitations to go back to Princeton and to Nassau Presbyterian Church, where Brubeck had been commissioned to write some music based on the poetry of Langston Hughes. And it was an extraordinary invitation and involved going to speak to an adult Bible class about Brubeck's music and what jazz might be in church. They invited me to bring my quartet down to play a concert as kind of a warm-up a few weeks before Brubeck and his gang. And then the actual weekend, which involved preaching a sermon at the church where Brubeck and his musicians were going to be there in residence. What I did not expect is that the phone would ring somewhere in the planning of that event, and Dave was on the phone inviting me to his house in Connecticut. And of course I said yes, so drove over 3 hours on 84, knocked on his door, there was no answer. I thought, my God, I've gotten the date wrong, what am I going to do? Knocked again, another door opened, and there he stood in his white terry cloth bathrobe, forgetting that I had come that day. He invited me in and turned to his wife and said, can we find something for him to eat? And so Iola was pulling food out of the refrigerator. We sat at his kitchen table, talked, got acquainted, and ended up playing about 20 minutes of duets at his two Baldwin pianos in his studio, just for fun. I went out to my car and floated home. It was the quickest trip I've ever taken. And our friendship really began that day. And we would keep in touch. We traded Christmas cards. When my wife and I married, he sent us a huge pewter fruit bowl as a gift. He invited me to Chattanooga for my 40th birthday years ago to hear some of the music he had written for the Pope, Pope John Paul II in 1987, and generally just kind of kept up the friendship over miles.
Tell us about how you've come to understand this spiritual sense, this deep spiritual sense he had and has in his music. Most people, you say Dave Brubeck, and it's Take Five and
right.
And that.
Some of the music we're going to play on April 23rd will tap into that. My friend, Dr. Jennifer Cogill from Marywood, will sing a piece from Brubeck's Mass. But the creativity begins with simply a surplus of imagination and the ability to connect the sparks of all of human life. And I think that's where spirituality begins. It resides there in our capacity for imagination and delight and our ability to imagine what is not possible. And then that becomes such a desire in the creative person when they're bit by that. They're going to take risks. They're going to try notes and rhythms they've never tried before. They're going to leap off the diving board into a pool full of sharks to find that one space where they can land correctly and not be touched and endangered. That's what it's like, I think, to describe it to others. Brubeck, when he recorded his Mass in the National Cathedral years ago on Telarc, takes this amazing risk in the hardest piece of the whole Mass, which was a 5-4 Alleluia with cross rhythms, SATB choir, full symphony orchestra, and his quartet, and they begin to kind of put this all together. And in one take, he literally does leap into the sharks, and he plays these impossible rhythms, and they land perfectly. And I had to stop the recording the first time I heard it. I couldn't believe it. And in chatting with him over the years, I realized he simply wanted to take a chance, and if it fell right, okay. I said, well, did you ever make a mistake? And he laughed and said, all the time. But I was never stuck with my mistakes. I was more consumed with the possibilities. And I believe that's where it began for him. Now, he was shaped by two older brothers who worked in church music and by a mother who was a piano teacher, had conservatory students. She was also the church organist at First Presbyterian Church in Stockton, California, the hometown. And they lived next door to the church. Dave said he also had a Pentecostal babysitter when his mother Bessie would go over to choir rehearsals. And she would be trying to pray in some exotic way, and he wasn't so sure about this. And that shaped him. Dave never actually joined an official Protestant or Catholic tradition, although he was probably more closely tied in part of his adult life to Catholicism than anything else. Did write a Mass, wrote, I believe, 13 major oratorios, and I can't tell you how complex they are. They were not just SATB, they were often double SATB, 8-part vocal harmony with accompaniment. And when he thought about accompaniment, it was often a full studio orchestra. You know, a little group like the London Symphony or somebody like that. So he had that capacity. On the 23rd, we don't have quite that budget. So it's mostly quartet music with a couple of friends coming to augment things.
You had an occasion, speaking of Stockton, to actually go to California and go to the archives.
Right. His archives are in the College of the Pacific, now the University of the Pacific, a school that he almost flunked out of in his senior year. He started as a biology student. His father was a cattle rancher and thought, of the three boys, one of them ought to go into the family business. They settled on maybe a veterinary school. But Dave kept sneaking across the college quad into the music building until a zoology professor said, Brubeck, just go over there. So Dave went over there and began to study. He was remarkable. He could pick up counterpoint. He could write and compose. He could analyze how Bach put together a fugue. He knew all of this music, just it came to him very, very quickly, all while he would be playing on weekends in Lake Tahoe with jazz bands. So a couple of quick stories about that. One was the students were in harmony class one day, and the professor put a kind of a problem up on the board and said, can someone analyze this? And they sat there quietly. He said, okay, one of you wake up Brubeck and get his read on this. They woke him up from the nap he was taking in class. He said, oh yes, that's whatever chord it was, and kind of did it and then went back to sleep. So that's the first story. The second is his senior year, second semester, he had to take a piano repertory class. He had to go in and play some of the classics, and they discovered at that point he could not read a note. He could not read a note. And the dean called him in and said, you are a disgrace. What do you have to say for yourself? Dave said, all I want to do is play jazz. But you're in a conservatory. You're here to learn to teach the classics, the greats. Dave said, all I want to do is play jazz. So they struck a deal. If Brubeck decided to never teach music, they would give him his degree. And that is a true story. He did not get a bachelor's in music. He got a bachelor's in special studies. And off he went. Sometime around the time that he got the Lifetime Grammy Award, the College of the Pacific decided maybe to make him Alumni of the Year. And they struck a deal over years that they would move seven rooms, large rooms, 20 by 20 rooms in his basement, stuffed full of memorabilia, scores, recordings, that they would lodge at the College of the Pacific and place his archives there. And having been through some of those rooms, it was staggering how much he kept producing for a guy who supposedly never learned how to read music. And looking back on it, I think he might have had what we would now call a learning difference or learning disability, where he kind of mixed up kind of a dyslexia or something. No one has really ever said he could write it and he could play what he had written, but he was more interested in the performance moment than what was actually bolted down in the black dots on the page.
What did you discover then when you went digging?
Well, discovered more than I could ever possibly imagine. This was a study week in last June. I came across, for instance, handwritten parts that he had added to the scores of music I've heard recorded. I discovered video footage that proved, in fact, he had been there writing a fugue and canon and fugue and chorale for Pope John Paul. 70,000 people there in the stadium, 700 voice choir performing his music. And one of the dignitaries had, let's say, suggested that Dave not improvise because they'll have no improvisations in a Catholic mass. So Dave sat with his white tuxedo, and at one point, the story goes, the pontiff came over to the edge of the platform, looked down upon the musicians, and gave them the sign of the cross. And his conductor and he were talking, and Dave said, did he just bless us? The conductor, a good Presbyterian, said, either that or he's trying to conduct your piece. So, you know, he had this kind of lively imagination and good sense of humor, even in the greatest pinnacles of achievement any musician or composer could have. We discovered that. We discovered footage. We could see it. I found and made a copy of the original bass part for Take Five. There's not much to it. And I found all these scores of music that were never recorded or never played more than once on a recording. So we're going to start our concert on the 23rd with some of that body of material. And we're calling it the Unheard Brubeck. And of course, now these days, all of his music is unheard. So that gives us license to play whatever we want. The original impetus for that, for which I received a study travel grant, was to explore some of his liturgical music, his church music, which has never been discussed much in public or journal articles. While I was there, another issue kind of emerged. You know, when you do research, something else bubbles up that you never thought to ask. And the question could be posed this way: why did the foremost jazz musician in the world shut down his jazz quartet at the peak of its supremacy in the musical world and begin writing church music? And there's no quick answer, because Brubeck was as complicated as any of the rest of us. But one answer was, they had as one of them said, we had been together so much in those 14 or 15 years that we ran out of things to say to one another. Because we were in constant communion, we saw one another more than we saw our families. And I think there's kind of a shelf life for a performing group. You go for a while, and then lives change and relationships change, somebody moves, and the complications are more than the glue that holds you together.
What of these will we hear then on the 23rd?
Well, we'll hear some Bach-inspired music. We'll hear the Brandenburg Gate, which he wrote in response to a State Department tour in the late 50s. Also, a two-part Contention, an earlier piece, which was a two-part invention written for jazz quartet. Again, very much inspired by Bach and counterpoint. We will hear Chorale, which is a later ballad that he based upon a choral fantasy of Bach. We'll hear Sara, which is a relatively unknown tune from one of his later albums. Dave, for his grandchildren, and Sara Bateson Brubeck was one of them, would base a melody or a fragment of melody based on their name, Sara Bateson Brubeck. You will hear the title cut of the suite of tunes he wrote, choral pieces he wrote in response to Langston Hughes, Hold Fast to Dreams. And one of my favorites is one called Everybody's Jumping, from the original album that also had Take Five. This was like a side B song that I'm astonished has never been picked up by other musicians. So we're going to try our best to reconstruct that and turn it loose.
Tell us who'll be with you.
Well, my longtime compatriot Al Hamm from Binghamton will come down and play alto sax. He will bring with him Mike Carbone, who plays tenor sax and flute. I mentioned Jennifer Cogill from Marywood, a neighbor, good friend. On drums, we'll have Ron Vincent, the Presby Bop Quartet drummer, who comes in from New York City. And bassist Tony Marino is not able to join us, so we were able to secure Steve LaSpina, who for many years played with Marion McPartland, and I'm going to ask him if he's ever played with Dave, as Ron did at one point when he was with Mulligan.
We always think about this rhythmic innovation, and you've described them so well in the 3-4 and 2-4, and what are we going to do here for? What is his sense of time? Is there an intersection between time and eternity? Do we get a sense of that kind of...
I think so. The great creative artists feel like, or give us all the sense that they're making a withdrawal on the bank account of imagination that is lodged in heaven or in eternity. And with Dave, there was a freedom, a well-disciplined freedom, where you can practice and practice and practice, but the moment comes, you simply have to let it fly and trust that there's a safety net of grace underneath you. And if not, tomorrow's another day and another gig, and on we go. I do think there's something eternal, something transcendent that happens in the creating of music. When I was going through a rough patch in the mid-90s, my friend Al called and said, we just had a gig. We're going to be up in Binghamton with the Madrigal Choir, a 40-voice choir. They're going to do a Brubeck piece. And I thought, what? And so I went, and it was Tony, and it was Tony Marino on bass, and it was, I believe, Tom Whaley on drums, and it was a piece that Brubeck had written on a Gregorian chant, variations on a chant by Thomas Aquinas, the Pange Lingua variations for the Cathedral of Sacramento. And there's one point where the SATB choir sings this haunting section of maybe 8 measures in parallel fifths, and the way it blends together, the polytonality it suggests, the eeriness, suddenly, I'll just say it because I'm a minister, God was there. I was astonished by the beauty of it, and then as quickly as I had that sense, it all evaporated. A holy moment, but enough to lift my spirits and point me beyond the mud and the mess that we often live in. It was almost as if that was the moment in which the bell rings, the altar boys ring the bell, and the Eucharist is transformed. It was almost as if that was in the thick of that music with those four voices. It was haunting, and then it was gone, and we began to jam in 5-4. And it's earthy, and your feet are tapping, and your heart is pulsing, and there is breath coursing through your soul. That's what this music is about for me. It is about more than committee meetings and buying more candles. I mean, the question this week in my church was, will we have enough candles for Holy Week? Maybe we need to order some more. And do we have enough ushers for bulletins and all of that, which is kind of the mundane, earthy part of everybody's tedious life? To realize at the heart of it, there is this mystery, and at the heart of that mystery is great joy. When Brubeck was laid to rest at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, and a few thousand of his closest friends dropped by to hear Chick Corea and John Faddis and Tony Bennett and others show up, one of the participants, and I believe it was George Ween, the founder of the Newport Jazz Festivals, said the word to understand Brubeck at his core is joy. There was something effusive and ebullient about this quiet, scholarly man, and something about how he would break into laughter when there was something really cool happening on the performing stage. There will be a couple of moments we hope to provide where there's no doubt that life is stronger than death, that joy is stronger than despair.
The Reverend Bill Carter, jazz pianist, leader of the Presby Bop Quartet, and pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Clark Summit, speaking with us about his friend, Dave Brubeck, in anticipation of the concert titled The Unheard Brubeck. That's this Sunday afternoon, April 23rd at 4 at the First Presbyterian Church of Clark Summit, 300 School Street. It's free and open to the public. And for more information, on the web, fpccs.org, and that stands for First Presbyterian Church Clark Summit. So fpccs.org, The Unheard Brubeck, this Sunday afternoon, April 23rd at 4 at the First Presbyterian Church of Clark Summit, 300 School Street. For more information, on the web, fpccs.org, fpccs.org. This is one of the tunes that will be featured on that program, titled Chorale.